Good evening, and welcome to Bathrop Spears Broadsides, the September 30th, 2018 edition, specially focused on, well, a large segment of it will be about David Rovick's concert and the events at the Loudon Nelson Center, both past and coming up, because the Rovick's concert was held at the Loudon Nelson Community Center at Laurel and Center, and some unusual things happened around that particular concert, or before it, actually. And we're going to be having a continuing focus on the attempt of some of us, Conscience and Action, HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, a couple of other groups who want to reopen the Loudon Nelson bathrooms, which are continue to be locked against poor people, and in fact, anybody in the public who isn't a part of their program, and a complete violation, I think, of the spirit of the Loudon Nelson Center traditionally, which is a public building used for public purposes, and also part of the gentrification effort to make Santa Cruz more unwelcome to homeless people in order to get them to, you know, move along, move out, get out of sight, get out of town. That at least is my interpretation. And there's a protest coming up around that issue on October 2nd at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. I invite you all to show, and I'll be talking more about that as we get into the show, but let's do that.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
Try that again. On the on the line with me is Joyful Heart, who has been keeping an eye on and working for the River Street Campground. How you doing there, Joyful Heart?
I'm doing all right, all things considered.
Yeah, I understand you've had some tough times yourself, and there may have been some trials out there at the campground, which, as most listeners may know, is right along Highway 9, right before you leave the city limits. It's behind a fence. I often point out it's got barbed wire, as well as little prayer flags on top of the barbed wire. And a long... I think you are to blame for the prayer flags. I was told that Susie O'Hara credits you with that. She's, of course, the assistant city manager who tends to duck questions when I raise issues about the campground. But maybe I'll get some straighter answers here. You were concerned back in August, and actually before that in June, as were some others, that the campground itself was about to be dumped in favor of some other structure or possibly no other structure. But then the city council, apparently unable to find a larger interim solution to its part of its homeless housing, I call it a hoax, but it does serve some people, its program, it decided to extend the campground until next April. Am I right so far?
Yeah.
And that, of course...
We did not expect an extension until April. It caught us all quite off guard. We were thinking maybe we'd get two more months, maybe till Christmas. Till April just completely surprised us.
Now, is that good news, I take it?
Yeah, it's good news for a lot of us. It means everybody who's here still has a place to live, and everybody who works here still has a job. That's a plus.
Mm-hmm. You know, go ahead, finish up. I mean, continue with what you were saying, if you'd like.
That's pretty much the answer to your question, that one question, yeah. So go ahead.
No problem. The other issue that came up when the Susie O'Hara, and I guess it was, the other assistant city manager who was covering this, spoke at city council in August, was the fact that you're getting 20 more tents, kind of, sounded like to me, shoved into the campground area, looking even more crowded as I, you know, from my brief vantage point as I pass by, looking through the...
Personally, I don't see how it's going to happen. So, I really don't. Maybe if the city council has some sort of TARDIS.
You still there, Swami?
Yeah, I'm here.
You're fading in and out there a bit. So there haven't been any new tents added. I thought I'd seen more tents, but I guess not, huh?
No, not yet.
And is there, you know, they were planning to move out some other service or some other vehicle or fill up some other fire road? What was the plan, or what is the plan?
So far, we have not been told anything.
Well,
here at the camp, we're scratching our heads, wondering, what is the city thinking? What's the city going to do? I mean, we've had a couple of people come out with measuring tape, but no response, no heads up, nothing. And quite frankly, those of us here on staff don't really see how we can fit 20 more spaces in here.
How many people currently are there? I keep calling you Swami because that's what I know you from before. I hope you don't.
Fine.
But you are, in fact, now these days known as Joyful Heart, right?
Yeah, well, Swami is also still correct.
Okay.
I'm just kind of been given something in honor of long time in service, I guess you could say.
Well, you do have a happy self-presentation, no question. So how many people have we got there in the campground now?
Well, you know, we've had a bit of a revolving door the last week or so. So this exact moment, I'm not sure, but it revolves around 50 to 55 people.
So I understand that there was room for 100 over 50 tents, theoretically, with two people per tent. Was that my good understanding?
The maximum of two people per tent. We do have some people doubled up, but most people who are homeless are single.
And is that because you don't have anybody who wants to get in, or because people are, in fact, either say they need the space or they've decided they want to demand it regardless of what other people? I understand there's a long waiting list for the campground. Is that true?
I understand there is a waiting list, too. I haven't seen it, but I hear that it's between 2 to 4 months long. Of course, that depends on how rapidly people move out. Mm-hmm. And people move out for a number of different reasons.
And what have those reasons been, let's say, in the last month, if you were to give us a picture of what happens?
We've actually had the entire spectrum from people who have been exited for breaking serious rules like violence and that nature, excessive drunkenness, which causes problems to the other people in the camp. All the way to the other side of the spectrum to people who have actually gotten housing.
How many? Go ahead.
And I really don't know the answer to that question. I work on the night shift. I don't see people when they leave. I don't know why they leave most of the time. I just hear, hey, this person's gone, and we've got this other person moving into that spot.
How many people, Swami, have you found actually have gotten housing? That you've heard of yourself from the camp?
Well, you don't seem to count Paige Smith, so that cuts out a couple of people. I'd say probably maybe 50% of the people who have moved out have moved up.
And how many would you say, how many have moved out, would you estimate, since you first got there?
You know, I've so lost track of that. I'm really sorry, Robert. I mean, I, I, I've been full-time nights for the last few months, and you really don't see that side of things when you work at night.
Well, what would you say, based upon your night work, and I admit that Lee, you get a different perspective there, what percentage of the people are still there who, say, came back in March? 50%?
Well,
yeah, you're an old-timer.
Yeah. You know, looking at it that way, there's actually quite a number who have moved out.
Or left for other reasons.
I'd say maybe 20 to 30% of the original people are still here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been kind of a slowly revolving door ever since.
Now, you were very optimistic about the campground in the last couple of conversations we had. In fact, you had hoped it would be a model for other campgrounds. And
yeah, I hope the city doesn't screw it up. What's working here is working.
I was going to ask you whether your mood has changed about that. But before I do, give me an example of how a typical day would go for someone in the campground, in terms of the services they have. I understand you have a charging station, you have showers, there's one meal a day, though I've heard mixed reports on the quality of the food. I've never had it myself.
It's gotten better, actually. They got a new chef over at HSB. So
the meal comes from the Homeless Lack of Services Center, as I call them, down on Coral Street?
Yes, yes.
Uh-huh. But that's one meal a day. So would folks usually, what, they go out to eat their breakfast, or how do they manage that?
Most of them have food stamps, because we have general assistance people, the county services people come in, and they help them get the food stamps if they don't have them. They come in three times a week, so a lot of people have their own food, and they share amongst each other, and it's really kind of fun watching sometimes, because, we have this one lady who'll come out, and she'll put out her own butter and bread for toast for people who want toast, and we have jam and jelly.
Now,
and sometimes we'll cook egg burritos for people who want them, but most of the time people go out somewhere else to eat.
So again, the schedule, as I recall it, used to be you had vehicles that would leave every 2 hours or so and have a number of sort of scheduled stops where they would leave people off and then later pick people up.
That's still going on.
And so a person who wants to leave has to wait until one of those vehicles is leaving. Is that correct?
Unfortunately, yes.
And what kind of problems or how has this been received? How's it going with this particular approach?
You know, I haven't heard complaints except every once in a while. The people who live here, it seems to be working for them. My personal opinion about it is it stinks on ice.
Mm-hmm.
I feel it to be a dehumanizing. I don't like it at all. But it was one of the bargaining chips that the city used to open this place, and so I got to put up with it just like everybody else does.
You know, I noticed that you used to have three levels of security. There were the people inside the camp. I guess you're one of the, in a way, theoretically security or helpful or, you know, monitors or whatever.
Well, if by security you mean keeping people who don't belong here out, then yes, you're absolutely right.
Or presumably if there's any consternation of problems between people who are there, you also perhaps deal with that?
Well, we're troubleshooters, yeah. I wouldn't really call it security in that sense.
Well, are you on a level whereas if you say something, people have to essentially pay attention to what you say and do what you say? Or can they say, look, you're just another resident of the camp, you have your opinion, fuck off?
Well, when it comes to enforcing the rules, yeah, I do have say-so.
Right. Yeah, so you're a security person. I mean, let's put it this way. You're an authority there.
I'm an authority, yes. There's a difference between being an authority and being security, because security is not my job. It comes up every once in a while out of necessity, but my job is host, okay? I serve coffee.
Oh, so you're a glorified coffee server? Is that what you're saying, Swami?
That's basically what I'm trying to say here. My job is to take care of these people, not police them.
Sounds good.
That's the way all the staff feels. Our job is we've got 50 people, many of whom have mental disabilities of one form or another, who are depending on us to take care of them. Mm-hmm. And those of us on staff, we take that really seriously. It's an important thing. And quite frankly, we don't give a flying fuck what the city is talking about. We don't care what the politics is going on. We don't care what the community is saying. I don't care what the NIMBYs are saying. You know, what we are doing is important to us.
So I noticed that there were three levels of security. I mentioned you were the first, the second, or the... I don't know if I call them the first alarm thugs out front or the, you know, first alarm services around the parks. And I don't know if it's Parks and Rec or First Alarm. And then there was the third level was the police van that used to be parked right across the street up one of the side streets. I noticed that van seems to have taken a leave of absence.
Well, you know, we always used to laugh about that because there was never anybody in it. I mean, after the first 4 or 5 days, the cops were like, yeah, these guys are nothing. It's nice to have an extra command post out here, but meh. Yeah, in fact, whenever we needed police, they would always come from somewhere else, presumably downtown somewhere, and it'd take them a while to get here.
How frequently have you needed police?
Very infrequently. It's I think we've done maybe 2 or 3 police calls the entire time.
Mm-hmm. What about ambulance calls for medical services?
Those are pretty frequent. I mean, we do have people on site here that have medical issues. We have several people here who are cancer patients. We've got old people here. You know how old people who live on the streets are going to have medical problems.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we do ambulance calls on average 2-3 times a week.
Mm-hmm. Now, when I looked in, and, you know, I've never been invited into the campground, and, of course, it was an issue that that was disputed at City Council as to whether people could leave the campground other than during the specified times to get onto the vans. And I think Susie O'Hara, or maybe it was Tina Scholl, assured us, I think it was Susie, she assured the city council that, oh, the entrances are open, the doors aren't locked, people can leave when they want. Although, you know, I don't think they got into the scheduling. Is that still the situation? Is that accurate? Am I mistaken in any of that?
I have never heard that.
Well, I was there at the council meeting.
If my bosses are saying that, they need to let us know because that's not what we've been told to do.
Are you letting people escape from your place, Swami? What's going on there?
No, people, if they want to walk out, we tell them very clearly, walking out is against the rules. If you do that, it's considered a self-exit, and you can't come back on.
So if a person violates a rule, are they, you know, gone, period? Are they gone for a day, gone for a week? What's the, you know, the chart of penalties, if there is such a chart on that?
There's no real chart. I mean, it's a case-by-case basis, really, and it depends on it's hard to really say, because sometimes what a person does, they're not doing it because they're conscious of their acts. They're doing it completely involuntarily, and you have to be compassionate about their mental condition, their mental disabilities. We have some people here that really need higher level help, but because of the way the system is set up, we are what they've got. And so we have to, sometimes we have to say, look, you know, this is against the rules, but we understand that you don't get it. So we're going to keep trying to teach you what the rules are for as long as we can put up with what you're doing, and if you're not causing harm to anybody else, okay, we're probably more likely to be a little lenient. That's really the bottom line. Is it hurting someone else in the camp?
Well, of course, the issue is, you know, what we were talking about a moment before is walking out of the campground, and that doesn't hurt anybody at all, except, of course, in theory, if somebody got upset because they saw someone leaving and thought they were a homeless menace or whatever. So
yeah, well, we constantly live under the threat of the neighborhood shutting us down.
In a real sense, or just because?
No, very, very real.
And what,
constantly live under the threat of the neighborhood shutting us down.
You repeat.
People are going to the city and saying, hey, look, we've been seeing people go in and out of here all the time. You guys need to do something about it. And the city's saying, hey.
I understand the theory, Swami, but have you had any indications in the last 3 or 4 months that that's an active possibility?
We have not given the chance. Uh-huh. They're very strict on this rule.
So you don't really know whether, in fact, there would be such a problem if people began to leave. You're afraid that might happen.
Well, we do have people who go by the camp every day expressing their displeasure at us.
Tell me about
that.
Tell me
about driving by twice a day, honking their horns, shouting at us. There's more than one. There's several different people who do this. So we kind of get an indication that there's an NBC here.
Huh. And have you ever...
But again, I have to say... While we would prefer it, this is what we're told. Yeah, I'm sorry.
No, I understand your reluctance there, and obviously it seems to me anybody who's wants to afford people basic human rights of the right to go to and fro and treat them like responsible adults, however mentally or physically disabled they are, would have the same position you have. It sounds like you have anyway, and that I certainly have. But the issue also is, this is the question I was going to ask you earlier, if I can skip back to that. Your positive attitude, and you still sound very positive, but I think that maybe because that's sort of your disposition generally, or your...
Well, no, I'm positive about what's being done here. I'm very concerned about what changes might happen.
Right.
I don't think the city is taking the right tack on this.
Well, that is the question. That was the question I was about to ask you, actually, which is, if you could make some changes in the rules or in how the campground was structured, what changes would you make? Since you've been there now for a number of months, you've got your finger on the pulse, at least in the nighttime, of what's been going on there. What would you suggest?
Don't take away our showers. One of the things, even though it's very, very difficult, the machine, to make function properly. It still is something that makes this camp tolerable for most of the people here. Do something about this shuttle thing. It'd be so much nicer if people could come in and out. But, you know, I really have no idea what to say about that shuttle thing. It'd be nice if people could come in and out on their own, but...
What else?
Yeah.
If you have thoughts on this.
It'd be nice to have breakfast. Mm-hmm. People would like breakfast. Or brunch, maybe. You know, a midday meal. Because sometimes people will come in mid-morning, you know, 9:30, 10 o'clock with donation, and it's... like some sort of breakfasty item. And about that time, the camp comes alive. It's like, oh, yeah, great, food stuff. So it'd be nice if we could have a second meal in here. As far as direct management, you know, the way we're running the camp seems to work really well for what we've got here.
How many of you are there who are running the camp?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know.
You're talking about a dozen, two dozen, five or six? Any estimate?
Somewhere around the range of two dozen. Let me see. We got three overnighters and probably 12 to 15 day and swing shifters plus three management. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, maybe 20.
Now, 20. Now, there's been some criticism. Well, before we move on to that, this campground was a follow-up to the San Lorenzo campground, which was considerably different. I mean, people could use drugs more freely. They could come and go as they wished. And most important to me, it looked like they had more space between camps and more privacy. When I look inside and see everybody sort of crammed up against each other, also particularly in the hot middle of the summer weather, I don't really cringe, but I wonder if people are suffering because of that. What is your feeling on that?
It doesn't feel to me like suffering. I mean, I live here too. Mm-hmm. We are close, but we do have a lot of space. Over and above the tent space, we've got dining area. We have a smoking area. We do have spots that get shady in the afternoon along the street side of the fence. You know, there's room to stretch out. It's not like a person's cramped in their tent. And plus, you can't really see it from the road, but along the back row, there's several of the campers have set up sort of suburbs, so to speak, for the tent city, where they put up large tarps, and underneath them are kind of their own private social areas for all of the tents that are under it. It's actually kind of cool. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it can be a little difficult because it's, you know, kind of like Japanese walls here made of paper. And you're right next door to your neighbors. You can hear what your neighbor is saying when he's talking to himself in the tent. And it's real easy to talk to each other from tent to tent. So it can be kind of tough that way sometimes.
What have been the challenges for people with special needs, such as, for example, a woman who gets pregnant, that sort of thing?
We actually had a pregnant woman living here for quite a while, and the reason she moved out was because she had her baby. Mm-hmm. We're not equipped for babies, and in fact, I think it's against the law for us to have them.
Hmm, interesting. Did she try to get back in?
Without the baby, yeah. But she and her man are on to better things now. He's found gainful employment. I'm not sure exactly what she's doing, but they got their act together.
You've talked to them recently?
Oh, yeah.
How recently?
I spoke with Clinton 3 days ago.
That's good to hear, because when I talked to them, they had a pretty grim story about what was happening to them in terms of CPS. So.
Yeah, well, there is that.
Yep. And actually, I'm going to probably play their story online here soon. I understand there have been some problems between people in the campground, you know, where some folks get upset with others, and there's problems that develop.
Well, you know, when you have 50 people living in the same house, that kind of shit's going to happen. I wouldn't worry about it too much.
Now, unless I'm victimized by it, I don't worry about it at all, of course. But I do report it, and that's why I'm, you know, trying to get different perspectives on what's going down. What have you had further connections with people outside? Oh, this is a question I think I may have asked you before.
Yeah, one guy actually just recently moved to, I forget where he said he was going. He's going to live with his daughters. He's going to help take care of them. He moved from here into an SLE. It's a sober living environment. Mm-hmm. And last I saw him, just like a day before he moved east somewhere, somewhere in the middle of the cornfields in the Midwest. I can't remember exactly where.
Well, when I say people outside, Swami, I really meant the great majority of homeless people who do not have the benefit of a $90,000 a month campground that is, you know, provides some services to people and certainly a safe place to sleep at night and to store your stuff during the day, although that, to some extent, is being helped by Brent Adams' day and night storage program, as I understand it.
I'm very grateful for that. You know, this is one of the things that I'm disturbed about with what the city is doing, because, you know me, I'm non-political, but sometimes things affect the people that I love. And, cutting out the winter program, the Associated Faith Communities is doing their best to pick up the slack on that, but they can only do so much. Brent, bless his heart, he's doing his best to pick up the slack, but he's not getting any kind of financial support for it at all, which, that's screwed up. He needs to get all the help he can get, because he's doing a good thing. I talk to the people on the streets, most of them are grateful for the help that I'm providing, because, just because I'm getting an income from the city doesn't mean I have to spend it all on myself. And I actually do, I try to help wherever I can. And talking to people on the streets, I'm more talking to them from the point of view of, what can I do for you? Or they're actually friends of mine, and, we're connecting that way. So I don't really hear much about their opinion of the camp.
Well, it's not so much others' opinions of the camp, although I have a question for you on that. But what the situation is...
I do have to tell you, this is getting kind of long, and I'm very, very, very tired.
But let me kind of quickly cut to the chase here. As you know, the camp costs $90,000 to $100,000 a month.
That's political. I don't go there.
My question to you is, if you had this kind of money, what changes would you make in order to, if you would, make any changes in how the camp is operated?
And that's not would not make any changes at all. What we have here works, and I'm terrified of any changes that are going to happen. Mm-hmm. Putting more people in here is going to actually make it cramped, like what you're talking about. It looks like from the outside, it's not cramped. We have room. Making changes of any kind will take away that room, and that's not good. No.
Well, the issue is $90,000 a good amount of money to spend on?
I really don't know. I don't know how much.
You're cutting me off here.
I've never looked at the figures.
Swami, let me finish my sentence.
People who have looked at the figures tell me, okay, well, maybe it could be a little bit better, maybe not. I don't know, Robert.
Swami, hang on a second. Hang on a second. The issue that is asked, and I don't have the answer to this either, but it frequently comes up, both from critics and the
take. And you got my answer. That's where I'm at. I don't know. I don't care. It's not my concern.
So in other words, let me get this clear.
I actually have a higher purpose that this is going to help me launch.
Your purpose seems to be interrupting what I'm asking, but I understand. I'm glad you do have a higher purpose, but the issue is whether, for example, for $90,000, perhaps the camp could be expanded to twice its size by having a second piece of property opened up. Perhaps it could be other things could be done. These are the kinds of things that, any individual might suggest. I'm not an expert at this either. But I would assume that you would have a sense of not just, let's not get rid of what we got because it's good, which I understand, but also, there might be better ways to do this. And you've already suggested a few in terms of, let's say, more space. They crammed a bunch of people into a relatively small area there. And I admit people seem to be doing, if you describe properly, the best they can and, expanding the space in their own kind of individual ways. But wouldn't it be better if it were twice the size?
Well, it would be, yes.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're asking me to, a better way of using $90,000, I don't know. I'm a monk.
Well, you're also a person.
Not a very good one either.
Well, you're operating. You're working in a campground to assist people, and you're aware.
That's my job.
Right.
I assist people.
Yeah.
I don't do the books.
But you're aware.
Care about the books.
I know, but you're aware of what
comes.
You're aware of what, Swami, what comes in every day and every night, more or less, on a general basis.
I don't know what it costs. I don't care what it costs. I care if the guy shows up to suck out the porta potties on Monday morning. I care if the guy comes to drain out the
right on
showers when the thing gets full. I care about it when one of my campers has an injury and needs to have 911 called. I don't care about how much it costs. And this is actually one of the reasons why Brent Adams is mad at me, because I have this attitude.
Yeah.
I've got a job to do.
Mm-hmm. How often are the...
It's not my job to say how the city's supposed to spend the money. It's not my job to say how the money could be better spent. It's my job to make sure that John... And
yeah, yeah.
Michael,
I catch the gist.
Make sure
I understand.
Make sure they have what they're
right,
doing.
And I understand you. You're also Swami. You're also aware of you know the deficiencies of what's going on, the needs of people that are.
You're not hearing me. I'm a monk. I don't care. Do you hear that? I'm not the person to ask these questions of.
Yeah, but you work there, man. You know.
So what?
Well, you get paid.
So what? You don't understand, Robert.
Maybe I don't.
About
you know,
money things. I don't care. You're asking me about political.
No, I'm not asking you about money. I'm not asking you really about money. I'm saying what needs are not being met there that should be met, considering what's coming in. And you
shower. If, I mean,
all right. All right. That's one thing.
Could yeah. be done, but right. We've been fighting that battle for the entire time the camp has been open.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really strange because we can't even find the. You know, my friend Steve has done research, and he can't find the manufacturer of this thing even.
Weird.
Yeah, it's a very, very strange thing that I think the city's hands are tied up. But, again, that's a political thing. I don't know. What could help? Get the NIMBYs off our back.
And,
that'll help.
Uh-huh.
Because none of the things that would really help are possible unless we move. And the NIMBYs won't let us. Listen, people, we're not that bad. We're trying to do some good here.
When you say the NIMBYs, have you had much conversation with these folks?
Not personally. I avoid them. I've got work to do. I don't really want to argue with people.
Mm-hmm. Have people tried to argue with you about these issues who are hostile to the camp? Or?
Not to me personally, no.
Well, Swami, you know, for a man who works at night and perhaps trying to get some rest during the day or at least enjoy himself, you've been very patient and you've taken longer than I tricked you into talking. So I don't know if I tricked you. I wouldn't say I tricked you because we keep talking and you can always hang up. But, you know, I do appreciate it. And let me give you the last word about any thoughts you may have that you want to pass on.
Oh, well, again, as always, you know, if you see a homeless person, help them. Yeah, and this is the, yeah, I like to call this the spiritual imperative. This is something that's the a pillar of Islam, is charity. In Judaism, they have a regular tithe, 5%, sometimes more, that a person is required to do, and that money is specifically used to help the poor. In Buddhism, caring for others, charity, in all the different religions, the spiritual imperative comes down to what's written in the Book of Matthew, chapter, 25, verse 36 to the end of the chapter, where Jesus says, whatever you do to the least of us, you do also to me. And, you know, I call it the feeding Jesus principle. If you are religious in any way at all, it is your responsibility to take care of the homeless. This is a cry to all of you who claim to be Christian. Stand up and be Christian. That's pretty much all I have to say.
Hey, Joyful Heart, thank you. If people want to get in touch, is there an email address they can reach you at, or how would you like people who have questions for you, or, you know, maybe looking for some...
Have any questions for me? You know, have them go ahead and ask you, and you can relay them to me, and I'll respond in kind.
Okay, give a call to 423-4833, and I will pass those on to Joyful Heart, who I've been calling Swami. And thank you, Swami.
You're very welcome.
All right, man. Have a good day.
I am going to. I think I'm going to take a nap now.
Good idea.
God bless you, brother.
Bye-bye.
attend the tale of Sweeney Trump, who made some promises on the stump to make America great again for white xenophobic misogynist men. He says the White House is a dump, says Sweeney Trump, the demon barber of clown town. His favorite cut, the overcomb, keeps everything atop the dome. His tax cuts help the 1% when he said the people, well, that's what he meant. That's Sweeney Trump, the demon barber of clown town.
Swing your razor wide, Sweeney, shake your tiny fist, waging your courageous war on journalists
and feminists
and ethicists
and rationalists.
Ivanka, Jared, and Vladimir.
But families on the border are seeking asylum in Switzerland.
And give is just a tiny thump.
But demon barber of Clown Town. Benefits for the poor he cuts, regulations galore he cuts, unions and jobs, healthcare and vets. There is no cutting that Sweeney regrets. International ties, he cuts treaties with our allies, he cuts. Sweeney will slash, Sweeney will sever, but will he ever apologize?
Never!
You don't really care, do you? You could not care less. Have your own ersatz boy come clean up your mess.
Attend the tale of Sweeney Trump.
Attend the tale of Sweeney Trump.
Who takes America for a chump?
Takes America for a chump.
He's got your back like Norman Bates, and he'd love to govern, but he often waits for Sweeney. For Sweeney Trump.
The demon barber of Clown Town.
And that was from Roy Zimmerman's new album, or I'm not sure how new it is, but it's new to me, Rise Up. And it's Sweeney Trump. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.3 FM, freakradio.org. Call-ins, in case you want to reach me, are possible, but not on the air. However, if you want to comment on stuff on the air or be on the air or have questions about how to assist in civil rights actions around homeless issues, give me a call at 423-HUFF, 423-H-U-F-F, 423-4833. It's a number you can find me at, or at least you'll find a machine with my voice, and I'll get back to you if you can leave me some kind of contact information. Phone numbers are good. Emails are okay. I don't tweet, and I don't text, but hey, you never can tell. I may enter the 21st century one of these years, or maybe not. So leave me a message if you have any concerns or reactions to the show that you think would be of interest to people in the audience, or if you're having some particular problems that you think we should know about that will have some public side to them that the community should be advised on. So as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, there's going to be a protest action and some food served, and who knows, maybe some merriment, some dancing, some clowning around, and some serious focus on the issue at Loudon Nelson Center, the community center at Laurel and Center Streets, on Tuesday at 1 o'clock. That's Tuesday, no, October 2nd at 1 o'clock, when we are going to be raising the issue again of opening up bathrooms that have been closed since March to the general public, but mainly to the homeless folks who showed up in some numbers, I believe, after the San Lorenzo campground was closed down by local police chief Andy Mills. and Mauro Garcia, the former head of the Parks and Rec Department, with a much smaller, more enclosed campground. You heard the discussion by Swami or Joyful Heart in the last 45 minutes or last half hour about that campground, the River Street Campground. But because that couldn't really address all the folks there, and because Parks and Rec rangers have been driving people out, ticketing people in the park areas, people move to these Laurel Park. I guess, why would you move to another park? Probably because some of your friends are there. It's near a bathroom. It's in the downtown area, so it's somewhat closer to services. It's you're a place where you could be, in a certain sense, a part of the community and less isolated if you have a problem. But as a consequence, Izeth Ray, the head of the Loudoun-Nelson Center, and her employees, I would hate to call them goon squad, since I know some of the people who work there, and I've been friends with them for a long time, or at least on friendly terms with them. In fact, one of them is a former free radio broadcaster, Skidmark Bob Duran. Hey, Skidmark, who, unfortunately, last I talked to him, seems to be supportive of the closing down of the bathrooms there, which may mean, you know, he has a point of view that you should listen to. I'm not quite sure what the rationale is. Maybe I can get him on the air to talk about it. In any case, we'll be there to talk about it and maybe to act upon it. We think those bathrooms need to be opened, and we don't mean in 2 months or in 2 years, as Rochelle Naroyan suggested at a recent People's Democratic Club candidate forum. She's running again for the Ashiti Council in the November elections. That's city council, to all you folks who want to show them adequate respect. Anyway, 1 o'clock, we'll be there with some food, with some merriment, and possibly with some civil disobedience. We're not sure what's going to happen, but there should be a way so that ordinary folks can use the bathrooms and not be treated like criminals, not be locked out, not be subject to intimidation, not be subject to interrogation, and so forth, as to simply do what those taxpayer-funded structures are supposed to be able to do for the community. I'll be talking more about that. In fact, you'll hear some interesting stories about how the Loudoun-Nelson staff treated Food Not Bombs activist Keith McHenry and folk singer and political activist David Rovics when they came to the Loudoun-Nelson Center as paying clients as part of a concert that they were throwing on, I guess it was last Wednesday. And I'll be playing that later in the show. What I'm going to do now is read a story from the Santa Barbara Independent, which is kind of a weekly that's maybe one step up from the Good Times, which is pretty horrible. They occasionally have longer stories there. I used to work in Santa Barbara as a homeless advocate with the Legal Defense Center 25 years ago when we were struggling with the same issues that Santa Cruz is struggling with now, namely homeless people demanding or struggling to be treated as human beings. And at that time, there was a larger number of folks in the civil liberties community who are interested in actually helping them. Here's a story called Homeless Rights Advocate Sue's City. And this is, of course, a story by it's by a guy called Nick Welsh. I actually knew him, not terribly personally, but I knew of him. But he writes about homeless rights advocate Peter Marin and his lawsuit. And you've heard Peter Marin, if you've been a regular listener here, in past shows. For nearly 2 years now, writes Nick Welsh, longtime homeless rights advocate Peter Marin has been threatening to sue the city of Santa Barbara over an ordinance prohibiting oversized vehicles from parking on city streets. Late last week, and this was September 26th article, Marin and his Committee for Social Justice organization made good on that threat, filing a federal civil rights complaint on behalf of 14 individuals who live in their RVs. Marin has argued that the city's ordinance that bans oversized vehicles, defined as any vehicle bigger than 80 inches wide, 82 inches high, or 25 feet long, was passed in 2016 to provide the city police the legal pretext to chase RV dwellers out of town while maintaining the appearance that they're acting to enhance traffic safety for motorists. When the city council voted to adopt the ordinance, it did so on the grounds that oversized vehicles blocked sight lines of motorists, cyclists, and pedestrians, thus making the roads more hazardous. Marin and his attorney, Russell Brown, argue that the law is inherently discriminatory because it offers a host of exemptions to many classes of oversized vehicles: delivery vans, contractor vans, tour buses, that are not available to people who happen to live in their RVs. Among the plaintiffs are about five who suffer from chronic disabilities. Some fit stereotypes of being rough around the edges, and so too are their vehicles. During last Friday's press conference in front of City Hall, one of the plaintiffs drove his beat-up RV around De La Guerra Plaza, honking his horn. "I get that I don't want that guy parked in front of my house," noted Brown, "but restrictions that say you can't park anywhere are unreasonable." "The Constitution gives all citizens the right to travel wherever they choose," Brown argued, "but the city ordinance effectively bans a class of people from the streets of Santa Barbara." At noon, many of the plaintiffs parked their RVs in city lots managed by the Safe Parking Program. That's a program we don't have in Santa Cruz, although there is an exemption from the camping ordinance, which makes it illegal to sleep in your vehicle after 11 o'clock at night, even if you're parked on legally in a registered and legal vehicle on public property in a legal parking space, or even if you're on private property, unless you are in a driveway for no more than 3 days per calendar month with a written permission of the owner of the property and the tenant there, or in a church or nonprofit parking lot, no more than two to a vehicle in a business parking lot. Maybe I think it's three to a vehicle, actually. A little unclear on that at the moment. And very few churches and very few businesses or nonprofits do that, allow that for people. So there's a lot of folks who are just looking for places to park. And in fact, this was a big issue in Santa Cruz back in 2016 when Rochelle Noroyan, the councilwoman I've mentioned earlier, who's notorious for her connections with Take Back Santa Cruz and other bigoted neighborhood groups, although I'm sure she doesn't see it that way, tried to push an ordinance which, first, she criminalized vehicles around the Circles Church, as it's called out on Arrett Circle. That was where Pastor Steve, who's since left town, was actually running a early morning cafe, a coffee cafe, for people who were poor and homeless to come in out of the cold. She was able to successfully drive that cafe away, as to say the neighbors were, with her support as a member before she was on the city council as part of the Public Works Commission. Then, increasingly, restrictive ordinances were passed. I'm not sure if this is with her support, but it was certainly with the support of the reactionary staff, making it illegal to park anywhere out by the homeless lack of services centers, Coral Street, nearby Fern and Limekiln streets. And this was the first time there was ever a 24-hour parking ban, unless you have a permit, in the city of Santa Cruz. Then that spread these no parking except with a permit to areas on the west side, right near the downtown area, in fact, near Loudoun Nelson Center, for that matter. And it's also true, of course, there have been no parking bans after midnight, completely unnecessary parking bans deliberately designed to drive away folks who are sleeping in their vehicles, or, quote, campers, as they like to call residentially challenged folks whose home is their vehicle. Getting back to the story by Peter Marin after that sort of brief divergence, I remember now why I wanted to make the divergence. As I've mentioned in past shows, Santa Cruz has tried to start, I should say some people in Santa Cruz have tried to start a safe parking program that is still going nowhere, at least in terms of any specifics that have come out of the city council or come out of Susie O'Hara, who is the sort of master mistress behind the River Street campground. She's the one who's the boss under Martine Bernal, the city manager, the guy who keeps the Loudoun Nelson bathrooms closed as well. And there was a proposal by O'Hara, and a claim that the city was going to be opening 50 parking spaces on the outskirts of town at one of the nearby churches, now run by or pushed by the Association of Faith Communities. At the same time, as you heard from Swami There is no program, unlike previous years, clearly stated yet, that allows for an actual winter shelter, even though that would be a token program or a limited program, somewhere between token and limited, that would allow only access to about 100 people. There's some rumor that it's going to be opened up at this year, at least at one location, as it was last winter, by the Association of Faith Communities at the Salvation Army on Laurel Street. I'm not sure if that's a true rumor or not, so I'll try to give you more information when I have clearer information about it myself. In any case, we don't have a safe parking program in Santa Cruz, and the parking program has the same kind of problems that Santa Barbara's does, in that it does provide safety during the night, but then people have to leave during the day. And if the city has created, like, let's say, Seaside, Monterey, Salinas have created bans on RV parking during the day, where do you go during the day? And also, if you're poor, how can you afford to go very far and spend gas money? Obviously, the people who are passing these laws have very little interest or sympathy in the situation for poor and homeless people, whatever they may tell you from their privileged chairs on the city council dais, or wherever they happen to be sitting. Anyway, back to Santa Barbara and this lawsuit that Peter Maron is apparently pushing in Santa Barbara. At night, many of the plaintiffs, that is those who are suing the city to stop them from going after their homes, that is to say their vehicles, their RVs, many of the plaintiffs park their RVs in city lots managed by the Safe Parking Program. Spaces, however, are limited, and the rules of conduct are restrictive. Guests, for example, are not allowed. Oh, sounds like the River Street campground, too. This rule, Brown argued, violated the constitutional rule of right to free assembly. Brown grew up in Goleta, which is one of the two nearby communities to Santa Barbara, and attended local public schools. He argued that the law was crafted in the first place to be a neutral-seeming measure, that's the anti-RV law, that could withstand legal challenge by activists like Maron, who argued laws explicitly targeting the poor are unconstitutional. Maron and City Hall have, in fact, been playing legal cat-and-mouse games over previous efforts to restrict RV parking in certain neighborhoods for nearly 20 years. While Maron hasn't won such skirmishes, he's proved a stubborn adversary and an effective nuisance. The new ordinance emerged out of those legal battles. But when it was drafted, owners of the larger Sprinter-style vans, many in the contracting business, came out of the woodwork. The Chamber of Commerce likewise assailed the ordinance, claiming it was anti-business. Exemptions were then included to assuage such concerns. Permits could be applied for, but only in parking spots that didn't block the sanctity of the sight lines. Maron and Brown objected that the ordinance has become yet another weapon in a war waged against poor people. First, they complained RV dwellers are given tickets they can't afford to pay, $48 a pop. Once 5 tickets accumulate unpaid, police can have the offending vehicles towed. The cost of towing is $810 plus $100 per day impound fee and $160 release fee, I should say. I'm hearing similar stories here in Santa Cruz, by the way. By comparison, Brown stated, the towing charge on other impound tickets is only $550. More evidence, he argued, of the ordinance's discriminatory purpose. About 5 RVs to date have been towed in Santa Barbara. City Attorney Ariel Colon said the ordinance was crafted with the expectation Maron would file a lawsuit. He deferred comment on the challenge until after he met with the council in closed session to discuss the litigation. And the editor adds, the story was corrected on September 27th, as there are 14 plaintiffs, not 24, who have filed suit. So a quick call to Peter Maron, Santa Barbara activist. Unfortunately, he's busy and running around trying to do apparently 2 or 3 things at once, as well as dealing with medical emergencies. So I won't be able to talk with him on this show. However, I'm hoping that that'll happen next week, and I'll be able to play some of the conversation I have with him either on Thursday or next Sunday. So in place of that, let's turn to a little further background on RV problems in different cities. Here is an article from Marketplace, to be followed by an article, When Your Home is Towed Away. Why don't we listen to that?
I'm Amy Scott. While home ownership remains out of reach for many people, so does just having an affordable place to live. The number of people in this country who were homeless on any given night rose last year for the first time in 7 years to more than 500,000 people. More people are relying on their cars for shelter. In Los Angeles County alone, the estimated number of vehicles as beds is more than 15,000. For people living in those cars, having it taken away could mean losing both their home and their work. From the California Dream Project, a nonprofit media collaboration, CalMatters' David Gorin reports.
It's chaotic here inside the lobby of the next-door homeless shelter in downtown San Francisco. And Sean Coyote, formerly of Lagos, Nigeria, says he really shouldn't have to be here.
The last job I had was delivering food for Uber Eats.
Coyote owns a car, a used red 2003 Mercedes-Benz he picked up for $1,000, and he used it to earn a living. Not that much of a living. He's been homeless for 6 years. For a while, he was sleeping in that car. But that came to an abrupt end one very early morning in March.
I wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning, and there was a guy behind me. And I'm like, what are you doing behind my car? Oh, I'm just waiting for the tow truck to come and get you.
San Francisco traffic officials towed and impounded Coyote's car a few hours later because he had too many overdue parking tickets. Coyote says he watched his whole world roll away from him.
I am a homeless guy that walked my way out of homelessness, bought my own car. Now you're taking my car, now taking my job, and now giving me food stamps. It doesn't make sense.
Coyote is not only looking at more than $6,000 in late fees and parking tickets, but the tow yard tacks on an extra $71 every single day to store it there. Now that he's 6 months out from losing his car, he'd have to pay more than $21,000 to get it back, which is about $20,000 more than he paid for it. So Coyote is suing to make the city give him back his car. According to Jude Pond, one of the lawyers helping Coyote, government officials shouldn't be allowed to tow away someone's home to pay a fistful of fines. He calls the state law that allows it unconstitutional.
We're hoping that this case sets the precedent that the city should not take people's only asset for the purpose of satisfying a debt.
If the restrictions were not enforced, then nobody would comply with them.
That's political expert Xavier Oslovsky, who teaches at UCLA now, but also spent 4 decades as an elected official in Los Angeles. So he gets why cities want to hold on to that impound power.
As a local elected official, I was never concerned about the revenue stream that we were getting out of the parking. It was motivated by getting turnover in the limited parking spaces that we have available at curbside.
Cities are allowed to tow a car away if it has 5 or more overdue parking tickets. A federal judge is expected to hear Coyote's request for a preliminary injunction to get his car back. Then Coyote hopes to start working again and maybe get a break on some of that $21,000 he owes in towing and parking fines. In San Francisco, I'm David Gorin for Marketplace.
And the story online, the printed version of the story, is a bit longer. I'm going to read a little bit of that, although it may repeat some of what we heard about Sean Coyote. I'll try to skip the parts where we've already heard from the narrator in this Marketplace story. For Coyote, who now lives at next door, his car wasn't just a place to sleep. It was how he earned a living, he said, delivering food through Uber Eats. He shakes his head in disbelief at where he was and where he is now. An estimated 500,000 cars a year in California are impounded, unclaimed, and sold, according to Jude Pond of the California Committee for Civil Rights in San Francisco. He said many of these cars belong to poor people living in them. Pond helped file a lawsuit on Coyote's behalf to challenge the California law that allows cities to tow a car away if the car has 5 or more overdue parking tickets. Many cities follow that policy, and Pond says it is unconstitutional in several ways. The government should not be allowed to take someone's property without any notice and without a warrant, he says. That's doubly true, he says, because these vehicles weren't used in a crime, but were towed simply for financial reasons, just to collect fines. Cities do not issue warnings outside of the fine print on a parking ticket that they're coming to impound a vehicle. Parking office officials just show up and take it away. And in the case of the homeless who live in their cars, city officials are taking their temporary home from them, which raises the stakes about the taking of a vehicle, Pond said. In San Francisco, officers towing a car with a homeless occupant will contact the police department and social services to help that person get services. And may I add, hearty har har. According to Paul Rose, spokesman for the San Francisco Municipal Transport Agency, who responded by email, there will be times when the homeless outreach team will not be able to respond. If there is no urgency regarding the towing of the vehicle, we will make an effort to delay the tow to allow services to respond, Rose said. We cannot completely avoid the removal of the vehicle, as this would create an unintended exemption for vehicles that are in violation of city or state law. And, of course, I'm not familiar with San Francisco's services, and there may be more of them up there than there are down here. Whether there are more compared with the number of homeless people, to me, is a really open question. If you look at the number of homeless here compared with the number of homeless there, obviously San Francisco has many times the number of homeless in Santa Cruz. Do they have many times the access to services? Somewhat, but I would say there's probably a serious gap, according to my general understanding of what the San Francisco Coalition of Homelessness tells us. Tens of thousands of Californians, the article continues, are living in their cars. In Los Angeles County alone, nearly 15,000 cars are used as homes, according to the LA Homeless Services Authority. Because losing these cars to impoundment can mean a loss of work and home, it can be a tipping point into a life on the streets. For many people, having their car towed for overdue parking tickets is a major annoyance and life disruption. But for homeless people, it's a permanent loss because most of them can't afford to recover their cars. And I might add, they lose everything in them as well, or it becomes difficult to get back and retrieve what they have, and then to find some place to take it or store it, given the fact that their home, their car, is gone. And the rest of this article, which I'm kind of scanning, has already been essentially read, or you've heard the actual voices of the people involved. His name is Sean Coyote, before in the actual spoken version that I preceded my reading of this. Homeless advocates say cities could make exceptions for extremely low-income citizens, maybe let them hold on to the car, but pay off the tickets in installments. Some cities, including San Francisco, have payment plans, but nothing in place to return cars to the homeless or restrict impoundment of those cars in the first place. A federal district court judge in San Francisco is expected to hear Coyote's motion this month for a preliminary injunction to get his car back. A hearing on this lawsuit will be scheduled after a ruling on the injunction. Of course, if the preliminary injunction is granted and the San Francisco has to return Coyote's car, he will still technically owe that $21,000 in parking, towing, and storage fees until the case is decided. Coyote, who has been homeless for the past 6 years, looks back on the incident and its aftermath with a mixture of anger and despair. "If I have my car, I have my phone. That's all I need. I can earn money," Coyote said. "But right now they're holding my car hostage. What I want to know is, does taking my car from me help the city budget in one way or another? Is my car going to make them or break them?" He stops a moment, looks around the crowded and chaotic lobby of the homeless shelter he now calls home. "I am back in the same hole," Coyote said, "and I don't have any way to get out."
Drain the swamp!
Drain the swamp!
Drain the swamp!
Gone,
Bonton is on. Let the good times roll in Washington. Open up Trump's crooked cabinet. Whatever's in there, they'll be grabbing it.
Drain the swamp.
Drain the swamp.
Drain the swamp.
So says Trump. Open season.
for misappropriators. Drain the swamp
to make room for bigger gators.
Those gaping jaws, those grasping claws, down below the surface, up above the laws. They're cold-blooded and reptilian, making off with another million. Aye! Says wood, watch him topping off at the public trough, eating caviar like a Roman off, unrestrained in their excesses, sitting round on their largesses. Drain the swamp. Rats and traitors, drain the swamp
to make room for bigger gators.
Another number from Roy Zimmerman's Rise Up, Drain the Swamp. Last Tuesday, there was a protest in front of the city council area outside, as well as some speeches made to the television and this council inside. We listened to some of that in the last show on Thursday. Here's some more of that, beginning with former council member Micah Posner.
Hello. My name is Micah Posner. I'm glad to see people here caring about the rights of people that don't have houses currently. And obviously, both ethically and according to the Constitution, the city needs to treat people that don't have homes and make sure that they have a right, that they're not treated with cruel and unusual punishment. In other words, that they're not criminalized for sleeping and that they have a place to go to the bathroom. So I'm glad that people are keeping this issue live. I was on the city council, and just in my opinion, I think the reason we don't have 24-hour bathrooms has to do with the city as a corporation, like not wanting to, not caring enough about citizens that don't have homes. Because what I saw in the council when I was there was that we did have a majority, including the council member Pamela Comstock from Take Back Santa Cruz, wanted the bathrooms as well. So it seems like in the community as a whole, and even on the council, there's a recognition that having bathrooms open helps everyone in the community of any class, whether they have homes or not. The problem is that the staff really don't want to do it. So they don't want to clean them all night, and they don't want to deal with it. So it's great that you guys are keeping this issue live for the community. My suggestion is that we all work. It's election season right now, so we have a unique opportunity to work to elect council members who care more about values and less about the nuts and bolts, you know, dollars and cents of each staff member. So Drew Glover, Justin, I think they would have a more idealistic approach to their job on city council, which hopefully would result in bathrooms being open more. But, yeah, I mean, obviously the city staff at all levels continue to violate the Constitution. They continue to promote cruel and unusual punishment by the trespassing tickets and other things and not having the bathrooms open. So we need a city council to stand up and impose values on the city as a corporation. at the moment, I think our best chance for that is to get a different city council. But anyways, it's great everyone's here and still caring about these issues and bringing them forward. I really appreciate seeing folks care so much.
Can you describe what happened with the bathroom situation while you were on city council? You mentioned Pamela Comstock was instrumental. Actually, she was the one who kept pushing the staff and actually got one bathroom open for half a year, the one in the Soquel parking garage.
Right, well, she and I were doing it together. I want some credit. But she was more of a surprise vote, yeah, because, you know, people assumed that she wouldn't care about that, and she did. So it's been a history of the staff either specifically outward rebelling or just kind of putting inertia in the way. I mean, there was one moment where Comstock and I actually put it in the budget to open that bathroom, and then the staff just didn't do it, period. Like, the Director of Public Works just ignored the fact that it was in the budget for 6 months, and then we finally put it back in, and then he did it for a while, and then the staff took it back out of the budget. And so, you know, it's the same with Loud Nelson. Like, the staff hate the idea of keeping the bathroom open. I think the public is really clear the bathroom should be open. So the problem with this sort of fragile version of democracy is that the job of the council is to impose values of the community onto the staff on a day-to-day level, and they don't always do it, and this particular council is particularly bad at doing it.
I'm back. Hey, who's next? Who wants to speak next?
I'm a co-founder of this Conscience in Action, Nicholas Whitehead. Speaker Micah, the former councilman, said that the staff don't like having to clean bathrooms sort of round the clock, even if it's overtime. I guess they still don't like it. But we don't have to have regular staff doing all that. It doesn't have to be a big union job, you know. We can have a public service corps made up of, you know, like the downtown cleaners who look after the streets. We could have a corps like that of lesser skilled people. They're not going to earn as much, but, hey, let's create some jobs, public service jobs, looking after these bathrooms round the clock. How about that?
Thank you, Nick. Sorry.
I'm going to say this to you privately. I've been looking for
you. No, we don't do anything private here.
Come.
It's all public. It's all public. Go ahead.
Come listen. So I spoke to the Downtown Streets team.
Say who you are.
I'm a social justice advocate. I spoke to the people at the Downtown Streets team in San Jose. They're very willing to manage the bathrooms. All they need is a contract and funding. So that issue is off the table, and I wanted to be sure you knew that.
Well, it's not off the table here. It's on the table here.
No, all we need is to get it going and give them the contract.
Sweet.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. My name is Dennis Etler. I'm an anthropologist. And I spent quite a bit of time in China back in the 1980s and 90s. And there were public latrines, you know, throughout wherever I went, in cities and country. They were rudimentary, you know, squat toilets and open pits and lots of flies, but, you know, they were available. But more recently, there is a new revolution in China. You know, China is known for revolution, right? Well, now in China, there is the toilet revolution. And the toilet revolution has been mandated from on high. Xi Jinping, the president of China, has actually been stomping the country, advocating for the toilet revolution. So I'm going to just read a little bit here about the toilet revolution, because, you know, it's much better said here than I could possibly convey. So here it goes, and this is from a major major newspaper in China, Global Times. And the title is More Awareness of Sanitation Needed, okay? China should continue to upgrade the country's toilets as part of its toilet revolution aimed at developing domestic tourism. Of course, we have tourism here, so if you want to develop local tourism as well, and improving people's quality of life, China's president Xi Jinping said. Now, just imagine if our president, would say something. Well, he talks about shit houses, doesn't he?
Yeah,
he talks about, these countries being, throughout the world being shit houses, but he doesn't do anything about the shit here in this country, now, does he? But China's taking care of that, okay? So, the construction of clean toilets is an important part of pushing urban and rural civilization. Now, get that. They're actually concerned in China about promoting civilized behavior. Can you believe that? And more efforts should be made in both cities and rural areas to upgrade toilets. So, Xi, the president of China, said in a recent instruction on the achievement of the toilet revolution carried out throughout the country. Along with the toilet revolution, China should construct better public facilities and services to boost the tourism industry, she said. She has long stressed the importance of the toilet revolution in enhancing the quality of the tourism industry, and officials are urged to make consistent efforts and take tailored measures to tackle long-standing issues and correct bad habits regarding toilets. Local authorities are now more aware of the important role toilets play, believing that better facilities are not only beneficial for tourism, but can also improve the environment that people work and live in and enhance the overall level of civilization of society. Now imagine that. There you have a government committed to a toilet revolution. Where is our government at all levels, from local to state to federal? Where is our toilet revolution?
Hear, hear. We've been listening to Dennis Hitler.
Yes.
So, this is a speak out, everybody. If people want to speak out, come over here and speak out about this. Everybody, the issue here is the Loudoun Nelson bathrooms, opening them up. Go ahead, Bob.
Well, I'll wait for the victims and camera.
Ready.
Okay.
Shogun, are you ready to speak?
Are you about to leave?
Think about it.
Dave, come on, right? you got his attention.
Let me know when you're good to go.
Where's this going to be published?
I'm going.
It's going to be on public.
The issue to me boils down to enabling homelessness. And I think that's the correct way to put it. It's the most strident way to put it. And the bottom line is we can only push this issue away so far until we morph and become, let's just say, for lack of a better metaphor, India, with the untouchables and homeless people living on the streets with no regard. So it's a question of leadership. And this is on all levels, including city, county, state, and national. It's an acknowledgement that something has to be done of major proportions. Now, the bathroom issue, as being expressed here today, is a very good pivot issue on this case for what do you do with the homeless. You keep pushing them away, or do you come to a point where you say, we simply have to enable homelessness in order to accept the reality that is before us, rather than continue to exist in denial, which is where we're at right now. So something has to change. It might be a couple of years away, and I've been refuted on this, for how long can you stop from dealing with the issue that, my goodness, if you drive down in this town, Coral Street between River and Limekiln, you'll see 100 people lined out in the street that are homeless and living in abject, wretched, disgusting poverty. So we can push it away maybe for a couple more years, but we're going to deal with this, and we're going to deal with it in a way that requires a great society amount of money. It requires redistribution of wealth and a change in our values. Where we're at now is a state of denial, and that includes leadership on the city council. Nobody talks about it. They say it's a regional issue. We don't have the money. They have money to build an arena in 90 days or less, and the money was raised immediately. They just sold the property in Scotts Valley for nearly $9 million. These things can be done.
We don't want to do them because we're afraid, once again, and I'll conclude on this, that we're going to appear to be enabling homelessness. And that seems to be a bullet through your political capital.
Thank you. We've been listening to
Bob.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you, Robert.
Good job, Bob.
Thank you.
Here you go, Bob.
Shogun.
Is Shogun?
Yes.
So we actually have a... You're outside, Shogun, yourself?
I'm sorry?
You're outside?
Yes.
Any good experiences with the bathrooms?
Bob LaMonica.
Thank you, Bob. Go ahead with what you, with your thoughts are on the situation.
I'm quite satisfied with my situation. I live outdoors. Mm-hmm. I have a safe camp, secure camp as far as I know. I've had nothing stolen. I've had no issues with the police officer or any authorities since I've been in Santa Cruz. Wonderful people here, friendly people. I am fully sustained, fully healthy. That one took a minute to come out. Please edit that out at some point. Fully healthy, and enjoying my life. I'm from the East Coast, Northeast Coast. I recently arrived in California back in February, and I fully intend to retire in Santa Cruz. I am not homeless. I'm fully independent of the system. And I'm fully unplugged unless I decide to log on to the Wi-Fi at their local public library. That's pretty much all I have to say. Do you have any questions?
Just wondering, because we're here trying to reopen the Loudoun Nelson bathrooms. Do you have any thoughts on that subject?
Well, I have quite a bit of thoughts on this. I mean, the situation is I've been on both sides. I had difficulty with my business, went bankrupt about 10 years ago, and a very, very difficult divorce. It almost destroyed me, and it's a long time coming back. So, having been on both sides of the street, would I want my daughters going in some of these bathrooms after some of these people have wrecked them? No. But now that I'm homeless, I need some place to go to the bathroom. Fortunately, I have taken care of all those things already. So it's a matter of both sides coming together and forming some type of agreement so that all of us can coexist together as far as I can see things in my limited perspective. Both the homeless need to, or not the homeless, because they're not necessarily homeless. Homeless, everything is a state of mind. If you change your perspective, you change your reality. So if you don't, I'm not homeless. I do not look homeless. I do not present myself as homeless. So from there, the social systems, there's enough income in this country, generated income, so that everyone can be taken care of. Everyone can be fed and everyone be sheltered. Okay, everyone should have proper health. But the situation is, and I don't have to go into it because we all are quite aware of this at this time, is that I'm not going to point any fingers, but those that are in power are consolidating their power and they wish to get rid of the people that don't conform to their status quo through the dogmatic practices that they have practiced and then transferred down through from generation to generation throughout history. We are living in a state of Babylon, and always are living in a state of Babylon. There's only one solution for that, but you have to figure that one out for yourself.
And we've been talking with?
Shogun.
Thanks, Shogun.
Rude boy, Shogun.
And more from the Tuesday protest at City Hall demanding reopening of the bathrooms after this musical break.